Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for conservatives today. And only one of them actually has to do with the presidential race, sort of. The first one kind of has to do with that. And that's where we start. The good martini. Jim, was back in the 80s that the Senate decided to open up its speeches to C-SPAN. And we're really glad that they decided to do that today, because Joe Biden, never shy of a camera during his time in Washington, back in 1992, took to the Senate floor in late June, which most court watchers will know is around the time of the final decisions for the Supreme Court session. They take the summer off. They come back in October. So what appears to be the day before the final decisions were to come down, just a few months after the very contentious Clarence Thomas hearings, Joe Biden went to the Senate floor. There wasn't even a vacancy on the court, but he decided to throw down the gauntlet to President George H.W. Bush anyway.
It is my view that if a Supreme Court justice resigns tomorrow or within the next several weeks, or resigns at the end of the summer, President Bush should consider following the practice of a majority of his predecessors and not name a nominee until after the November election is completed.
So he didn't think it was just a bad idea in those circumstances. It was a bad idea in general. And he even invoked two of our, let's just say, less than quality presidents in encouraging the Senate not to necessarily even take action if the president does dare to nominate someone.
It is my view that if the president goes the way of Presidents Fillmore and Johnson and presses an election year nomination, the Senate Judiciary Committee should seriously consider not scheduling confirmation hearings on the nomination until after the political campaign season is over.
Now, of course, what we're hearing from the White House is they have time to nominate a replacement to Justice Scalia. It doesn't matter that we're in a campaign season, but that's not what Senator Joe Biden said at all back in 1992.
It would be our pragmatic conclusion that once the political season is underway, and it is, action on a Supreme Court nomination must be put off until after the election campaign is over. That is what is fair to the nominee and essential to the process. Otherwise, it seems to me, Mr. President, we will be in deep trouble as an institution.
Oh, Jim, how delicious was this?
What we didn't hear, he spoke very quietly, wasn't picked up with the microphone, is, as long as it's a Republican president doing the picking. If it's a Democrat, we all got to confirm him. It's totally what we got to do here. It really is, on the one hand, absolutely delicious. And I understand the vice president issued a very brief tweet yesterday. He said, all I was saying back then is we should follow the Constitution. No. No, Mr. Vice President, that's not what you're saying. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that the U.S. Senate has to hold hearings. There's nothing in it that says they have to hold a vote. There's nothing in it that says you have to vote for the president's nominee. In fact, failing to do any of those things is considered advising and consenting. And you've said, we think this person isn't even worth considering. If the president were to nominate Kanye West, right? I'm trying to think of the single most incompatible, awful choice I could imagine. At some point, somebody's saying, wait a minute, Kanye would make a good justice. Basically, the court can say, no, we don't think that person is worth it. A whole bunch of them. Harriet Myers never was withdrawn before a vote. This is how it works sometimes. We'll see how the president nominates this. But look, Obama filibustered Alito. Harry Reid has filibustered and blocked nominees. Pelosi has endorsed it. Every single Democrat is totally okay with every single move in the book to block a nominee, as long as it's a Republican nominee. Once it's a Democratic nominee, they want to change the rules. Sorry, guys, doesn't work that way. You made this bed, now you got to sleep in it. And we're just going to enjoy quoting the president and quoting the vice president back at you for as long as this fight goes on.
Jim, what do you make of some politicians on the left and some media who certainly lean to the left saying, look, both sides have been hypocritical about this. Let's just throw out all those comments, call it a wash, and let's just follow the Constitution and let the president put forth his nominee and move the process along.
Terry Moran of ABC News basically made that argument to me last week over Twitter. And he's a nice enough guy, but basically says, let's just let bygones be bygones, and you guys unilaterally disarm first. No, you first, right? You know, like everybody's always convinced that one person, somebody said, ah, you guys are still mad about Bork. It was 30 years ago. Look, this Bork is what set up this modern criteria. Up until then, it was a fairly common to see bipartisan approval of you know, people getting 90 to 100 votes for somebody. Democrats changed the rules. Now we're playing under the exact same rules that they set up back then. And they're saying it's totally unfair and completely unacceptable and the greatest abuse of the Constitution and, you know, the earth is going to crash into the sun and all that stuff. And we're just not having it.
All right. Speaking of unilateral disarmament, let's move on to the second martini now. And the president on Tuesday morning stood before the cameras at the White House and announced that he was finally moving forward his proposal to do what he vowed to do in the 2008 campaign.
Today, the department is submitting to Congress our plan for finally closing the facility at Guantanamo once and for all.
And then came a whole series of arguments that's going to make people frustrated on the right. First of all, he says Guantanamo Bay has made us less safe.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. This is not just my opinion. This is the opinion of experts. This is the opinion of many in our military. It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
Beyond that, he says we need to go back to the criminal justice approach to terrorism, saying federal courts are way better than military tribunals.
The most effective option for dealing with individuals detained outside military theaters must be our strong, proven federal courts.
He also is suddenly worried about how much money we're spending on this and says we could save $1.7 billion over 30 years. But, Jim, then came the stuff we really love from Obama. First, he says he understands why Americans are leery about moving terrorist detainees from Guantanamo to facilities inside the United States.
I think a lot of the American public are worried about terrorism, and in their mind, the notion of having terrorists held in the United States rather than in some distant place can be scary. But part of my message to the American people here is we're already holding a bunch of really dangerous terrorists here in the United States because we threw the book at them. And there have been no incidents. We've managed it just fine.
Yeah, we're just scared. And of course, no Obama speech would be complete without this.
If we don't do what's required now, I think future generations are going to look back and ask why we failed to act when the right course, the right side of history and of justice and our best American traditions was clear.
You're a terrible American if you oppose this, Jim.
The right side of history. By the way, like, look at the state of the world when Obama took over. Look at the state of the world today. How's the right side of history doing? Anybody feel like we got some backsliding? Anybody feel like the wrong side of history is racking up some wins, particularly all over the Middle East? The one kind of semi, you know, decent point Obama makes in there is that, yes, we have very dangerous people inside our supermax facilities. And you could argue that any prison that can hold an Eric Rudolph or Timothy McVeigh could probably hold an al-Qaeda terrorist. On the other hand, these guys are not American citizens, right? So they, you know, very, you know, we don't put Americans in Gitmo. So they are not prisoners of war, and they are not American criminals. So they don't really fit either of these two categories, and that's why we created Gitmo. Most Americans don't feel any particular need to do this. The polling has never been on Obama's side on this issue, and they never have his argument. This is a propaganda tool for terrorists. These are the people who believe in vast Jewish conspiracies, right? There's nothing rational in the thinking of terrorists. If we shut down Gitmo tomorrow, ISIS isn't going to change one bit. Al-Qaeda and the Al-Nusra Front are not going to close up shop and go home. Stop telling us that closing Gitmo is an effective tool against it's going to stop terrorism. It's not. And Obama's been making this argument. And the reason it hasn't happened for 8 years is because a lot of lawmakers, including a bunch of Democratic lawmakers, don't want Al-Qaeda to say to their constituents, hey, I made the decision to bring a whole bunch of Al-Qaeda terrorists to the prison down the street. And for obvious reasons, you know, Americans don't like that idea. The argument of the international community and all these folks and angry Muslim populations around the world, like, oh, my goodness, you know, Gitmo is this awful prison and you are bad people for putting them there. No, we're not. The people who blow up innocent people, those are the bad people, right? We are not the ones who are who have something to account for here. And so Obama plays into this. It is this, you know, runaway ego gratification. Congress has already passed laws saying, no, you cannot bring these prisoners here. He's out once again in defiance of Congress. You know, wasn't he talking about the need for a changing the partisan tone a couple of days ago, Greg? Weren't we supposed to be more respectful to each other and more understanding and empathy and all of that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess that reached its expiration date then.
Yes, it's too bad that we had Guantanamo before 9/11 because, oh, wait, we didn't, because that obviously inspired the 9/11 attackers. Anyway, on to the crazy martini now and back to domestic politics. We touched on this a little bit yesterday when we were talking about why certain people are not joining Jeb Bush and getting out of this race. We mentioned Ben Carson, and we also talked a bit about John Kasich, and now there's more evidence to suggest that Jim was right about John Kasich yesterday because there's a new poll out in Kasich's home state of Ohio, where he is losing to Donald Trump by 5 points. He's in second place, which isn't terrible, but in your home state, you kind of like to be ahead if that's your firewall. And we still have no good evidence that Kasich is doing particularly well in Michigan. He also had a town hall yesterday where he was talking about his first campaign for office in the 1970s and talked about how his campaign really got a spark when the women left the kitchens to go put out yard signs. That resonated well among the women in the Republican Party. And I got this email earlier, I guess this was last night, Jim, just to talk about tone deafness in the campaign. Kasich's campaign touting the fact that they've got another billionaire supporter, the hedge fund titan Julian H. Roberson, their second billionaire investor to endorse Kasich in as many days. So, you know, he's the champion of the little guy there, not exactly on message.
People have been listening to this podcast and reading me in the corner, reading the Morning Joe. Well, no, I am not the first guy to rush to the aid of John Kasich. I'll assume with his, you know, women coming out of the kitchens to support him, simply poorly worded, and he's not saying the Kasich administration, women will be barefoot and pregnant and back to the kitchen and all
true,
that.
True, true.
But on the other point, you know, you mentioned that he's in second place in his home state. Not by a lot, but a 5-point margin indicates that it's like that. There's some previous polls that were kind of more or less in line with that, showing Trump ahead. Greg, guess what you get if you come in second place in Ohio's Republican presidential primary?
0 delegates.
Nothing. Yes, you don't even get a set of steak knives. Sorry, guys. Oh, I'm sorry, Governor Kasich. So close, but no, you go home and you don't get it. Yeah, it's one of those winner-take-all states. So if he ends up just one vote behind Trump, he gets nothing. Now, you might be able to say, okay, well, Rubio's in trouble in Florida, too, and that's a winner-take-all state, and all these guys are having trouble against Trump. Except John Kasich, you know, he did nothing in Iowa. Wasn't going to be his best state. He kind of basically said, I'm not going to compete there. All right, fine. I'm putting all my resources into New Hampshire. And he did do second place in New Hampshire. But then he did really not much of anything in South Carolina. And you look at all these states that are going to be – he's not expected to do very much in Nevada tonight. He's not going to do very much in the March 1st states. He's not going to do much in the March 5th states. You know, at some point, you can't be a boutique candidate who just chooses to compete in about 10 states or something. The argument is that Kasich was going to have this Midwest beachfront, and that was going to be where he was going to do well. And he'd be able to say to the nominee, hey, I'm the kind of guy you should put on the ticket. I can help you carry Ohio. I can help you carry the upper Midwest. He's at 6% in Michigan, by the way, Greg. So at this point, he's almost explicitly running for vice president. What are you doing? Can we narrow this down to the people who really want to run or who really want to have a chance at winning? Is this unreasonable? Apparently it is, Greg. Apparently it is.
Well, I'll tell you why Kasich's not doing well in Michigan. He's a big Ohio State fan, and he's very public about that. In fact, last year, he actually had a resolution encouraging people not only to wear the colors of Ohio State for the Michigan game, but to refrain from even saying the word Michigan on game day. So, I mean, that goes back to Woody Hayes and the huge rivalry that exists there. But, you know, if you're on the fence, that might tip you the other way in Michigan. So
I was going to say, how many Michigan Wolverine fans are just never going to give Kasich the time of day?
And finally, what do you make of the, I think it was Larry Sabato that first floated this yesterday, that Rubio should announce that Kasich would be his VP and kind of run as a ticket. That way you get Kasich out of there, and anybody who actually likes him would gravitate over to Rubio.
I'm sure on paper this makes sense. You could say, oh, the Republican ticket would have a guy from Florida and a guy from Ohio, and wouldn't that be really great in the two states you really got to win? Greg, could you just imagine their conversations? You know, my dad was a bartender. Oh, really? My dad was a mailman. Really? My dad was a bartender. Oh, yeah, my dad was a mailman. Just going over and over in circles, over and over again. You think your dad was had blue collar working class roots? Let me tell you about my dad, and just go around over and over again. Yeah, you know, if Rubio gets the nomination, not a likely scenario at this point, but you know, certainly a possibility. I just feel like there's so many options that give you so much more than John Kasich. But right now, I think a bag of Doritos gives you more options than John Kasich.
Oh, can't beat that. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And join us on Wednesday when I'm sure we'll be talking about the results of the Nevada caucuses on the 3 Martini Lunch.